Commissioner Holland has a long list of talents and things that he's accomplished that I'm supposed to read to you. And you don't summarize a man in this kind of a list. But he was born in St. George, and he has degrees from Dixie College, Brigham Young University, Yale University. He's been an instructor, an administrator in the institute system of the church in California and Connecticut and Salt Lake. He's been in Seattle, Washington also, and has taught religion at Brigham Young University and has been dean of religious instruction at BYU. He's been a bishop on two high councils, a counselor in a stake presidency, and is currently commissioner of the church, in which there are a good many 100,000 students enrolled, including universities, colleges, institutes, and seminaries throughout the world. He's married to the former Patricia Terry. They have three children. But above all, I think we need to think of Commissioner Holland as a warm, generous, kind person concerned about the individual welfare of each one of the many thousands of students in the church. And we're glad to have him here, and hope that he'll always feel as welcome at Ricks College as we are glad to have him here.
Thank you, President Maxwell. I love to be at Ricks College. I guess there's nowhere in the world I'd rather be. At a devotional hour on a Tuesday than right here. I've looked at you and wondered where you are from and what you're doing and how confused you are. And it's about all of that that I guess I want to speak today. Because it's early in the year, because President Maxwell's been kind enough to invite me at the time that he's invited me, I'm going to give you a little different talk than I might give some other time. I hope that's okay with you. And I hope you have a great year. I hope that part of what I say will have something to do with your having a great year. If you don't, I'll be deeply disappointed, because I think you are entitled to as fine an experience as you'll ever have in your life, right here on this campus. I noticed as we came in, there was quite a little buzzing going on, and somebody suggested, well, it isn't quite as quiet today as it will be later on. And you know why it isn't quiet. I know why it isn't quiet. You're all in here sort of sizing each other up. And gee, she's cute. She's cute. Who's she? Where's he from? What's his name? I've got him. Don't kid me. I was your age once. That was back when Lorenzo Snow was the president of the church. I suppose you know what kind of pressure that puts on a speaker. I've come here to talk to you about the seagulls and the crickets. All you've got on your mind is the birds and the bees. I don't know what kind of sermon we get out of that, but I'll try to understand you if you'll try to understand me. I had a student once, just about this time of year, I think it was about the second week into class, into the term, and she came in tears. I was teaching a religion class. And she came just in absolute tears. And she said, oh, Brother Holland, it's the worst experience I've ever had in my life. It was just horrible. It was just the worst experience I've ever had. And just beside herself. I didn't know whether to call the hospital or security. But I said, what, Christy, what was the worst experience you've ever had? She said, a computer date. I had a computer date. You know, it was early in the year, and the student body officers were trying to get everybody sort of introduced and welcomed, and they had a computer date. I don't know, maybe you're going to have a computer date. Maybe you've had a computer date. Maybe somebody's sobbing out in the audience. I don't know. But she came and said, it was just the worst experience I've ever had. She said, it was just like final judgment. And I said, what on earth was like final judgment? And she says, well, there I stood, face to face with exactly what I deserve. You may want to think of other options to the computer. I don't know that that's, you know, finally, romance is an art. It isn't really a science. I'll leave you to your own devices to work through that. I suspect you're already devising a little bit right now, and this semester's only a couple of weeks old. You probably wonder who I am. I'm wondering who you are. Not really. I know who you are collectively. I'd be delighted to know you individually. You don't know me. And some of you are saying, who is this Holland and why has he come to take our time? All I can say to that is that I'm defenseless. I've been invited, and I hope I get to know you through the course of the year. And I hope you'll be pleasant enough to come up and introduce yourself when you see me on campus. I hope I can come often. But it does remind me of the only other joke I know, and I'll tell it, and we'll get right on with the devotional. But it's the story. This is about World War II. You've read about that. That was the war just between the Romans and the Greeks. Before any of you were worried about wars. I don't know where this guy was from. He might have been from Ryrie or Rupert or Roberts or Rexburg. Those are my favorite R's. I always like to say them. For that matter, he might have been from St. George. I didn't tell Brother Maxwell what I always say to the faculty, and that is that I don't just jump up and introduce myself as being from St. George. This, by the way, isn't a joke. I'm trying to get to the joke. I don't just run around and tell people I'm from St. George. That doesn't get you off to a great start. Now, I don't know whether if you're sort of from Idaho, you may not know too much of the burden we bear in St. George. But J. Golden Kimball went down there and spoke at a state conference and said if he owned the two, he'd rather live in hell and try to rent St. George. We carry a certain burden, I think it's something that none of you from the upper Snake River Valley can fully appreciate. Rolf Peterson said it was the only place in the continental United States that a harpsichord was a harpsichord. So in any case, for all I know, this guy was from St. George. Maybe he wasn't from Ryrie or Rupert or Roberts or Rexburg. Isn't there? I think there's another one. Rigby. Why not? throw Rigby in there. Rigby. Let's hear it for Rigby. I've got to move right on with this talk. My time's nearly up. This soldier was in Great Britain. See, I told you it's early in the year. This isn't the kind of talk I'd normally give you. It's early in the year, and you can understand my sort of pleasant approach to the semester. It'll get grim around semester and final time, midterm. But this soldier, from wherever he was from, went to Great Britain in World War II and hated it. He hated the rain, he hated the food, he hated the people, he hated the war, he hated the army, he hated everything. Thought his girlfriend wasn't going to wait for him, he just hated everything. And one day, in total exasperation, he picked up the phone and called the only telephone number that he knew. It was Supreme Allied Headquarters. And he just got somebody on the other end of the phone and he said, I hate it. I hate the army. I hate this war. I hate the rain. I hate the food. I hate the... You know, and he just went on and on and on, just beside himself. And there was a sort of a silence on the other end. And then this very dignified voice, very military voice, said, young man, do you know who this is you're speaking to? And the guy says, no, I don't, and I'm not sure I care. Well, there was another little pause, and then this very dignified voice said, this is Dwight David Eisenhower. And there was another little silence. And then this young man said, well, do you know who it is you're speaking to? And General Eisenhower said, well, no, as a matter of fact, I don't. And he said, well, thank the Lord for that. It's just as well that you don't know me too well, because if it's a bad talk, see, you won't leave the church, your parents won't stop paying tithing. But I do hope we get acquainted during the course of the year. I want to talk to you seriously about what it is I think you've come here to do. Could I just have, by a very silent show of hands, how many of you are here for the first time? First year of some sort. Okay, that's a lot of you. To you especially, and as a reminder, on a message that I've never been able to give yet, and will now, to the sophomores or the second year, or the returned missionaries, or whoever has come back. I want to talk to you about why I think you're at Rexburg on this campus today for this term. And I need to have you shift in tone and attitude for a minute with me in spirit and consider maybe the most serious question I could pose to you, because I believe it is a real question. I believe it is a question that was asked once, and it could conceivably be a question asked again of you. And it is the question, it is the proposition and the invitation for you to consider yourself at this moment as God. That is a heretical notion. It would almost be blasphemous to say that in many, many religious settings, as well as secular or atheistic or antagonistic settings. But to a Latter-day Saint, that ought not to be, as long as it's handled sensitively and carefully and well, that ought not to be a stunning question. Because this is a church, we are a people, these are beliefs that teach us that indeed, if we live so, we can not only become like God, but we can become God, a goddess, a king or a queen, a priest or a priestess of the Most High. And we believe that. And whatever you've been doing since junior Sunday school and through primary and seminary and on the Rexburg campus and whatever else it is you're going to do, somehow, whatever it is you're doing is supposed to be oriented toward that. Okay, now I'm just going to move the clock up a little and ask you to say, what if you were now in that position and you were faced with the issue that our Father in Heaven was faced with 100 and not quite 50 years ago? Well, that's the organization of the church. If you want to talk about his introduction to Joseph Smith, then we move it farther than that. We really can talk about 100 and nearly 90 years ago. If you want to take Joseph Smith's birth and prepare a young man and bring him along, then you understand the setting I'm inviting you to place yourself in. And you're going to prepare this boy from upstate Vermont and down through New York and prepare him for a very fulfilling life and a very early death, tragically enough. And you're going to talk to him, and you're going to say certain things to him, and you're going to have him do certain things. Okay. What will you do first? Now, the problem is that you've done this kind of thing before. This isn't the first prophet you've ever had. In fact, in terms of dispensations, it isn't the first. It is quite literally the last for this world. You will call it the dispensation of the fullness of times. And that will include the last times, i.e. last days. So you've been through this before. You've had people like Enoch and Aaron and Moses and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah. You've had Almas and Moronis and Mormons and Nephis. And so the kinds of things that you've done many times before. But now it's after a long period of darkness. It is what we traditionally call a great period of apostasy, and you're going to do this one more time. If we had the time, and we don't, we could open the Book of Mormon to the fifth chapter of Jacob and read about it in figurative language. It's a story about a vineyard and a lord of the vineyard and some servants who just can't ever make it work very well for very long. They plant here and then they plant there and they cut off branches and they graft in branches and they change ground and water and prune and irrigate and dig the weeds, and nothing ever works. And it isn't that they don't work hard, it's that somehow these people, these branches, these trees, resist it. They don't want it. They choose something else. And there is a moment in the fifth chapter of Jacob where the Lord of the vineyard is there, and in your Book of Mormon class this year you'll come to it, where the Lord of the vineyard is there with his head in his hands, crying, weeping, it says, that's the scriptural word, saying, "What more could I have done for my vineyard?" And that's what I'm trying to set up for you. If you feel that way, if you've gone through this and gone through it and gone through it, and for any period of time it never seems to work. Oh, you've got little bright spots. You've got a city of Enoch here and a period in Zarahemla there. A Genesis period or a fourth Nephi period, but not very many of them, and not for very long. And here you're trying it, or you're going to try it one more time, because that's the counsel you receive. Let's try it one more time. Don't burn the vineyard yet. Let's try it one more time. So what do you do first? You're going to do it one more time. You're going to give it the best shot you've got. best ground, best irrigation, best fertilization, best care you can give it. Now what do you do? You've brought a young man along and you're going to start, but where do you start? How do you start? Well, you think through of all the things you've got to do. This is the dispensation of the fullness of times. You've got to do it all. You're going to stuff everything back into this period that ever meant anything to anybody for any period of time from Adam to the end of the world in some representative way. That's part of the meaning of the fullness of times. We're thankful to the prophet Joseph Smith for that explanation about what the meaning of the dispensation really holds for us. Well, okay, let's start with temples, right? If you're going to think of that distinctive ordinance, that characteristic and endowment and ability that Latter-day Saints have that we believe is lost to the rest of the world, so that we have to do it for the living and the dead, let's start with temples. Let's build a temple first. Get the endowment out. That ought to be the thing to do. Right? Wrong. When do we get a temple? When do we have anything approaching a reasonable, complete endowment in the sense that you and I would know it if we went down to Idaho Falls? Is it 1820? Is it 1830? It isn't 1820 or 1830. It isn't even 1840. In fact, it's 1844, the year of the prophet's death. That's when we finally get a complete endowment in Nauvoo. And the temple isn't even completed then. Well, you don't start there. As important as it is, and maybe that's sort of the final thing you do, but at least it isn't the first thing you do. I know. Aha, aha. Relief Society. Organize the Relief Society, right? Get the Relief Society going, everything else in the church will happen. That's sort of the rule of thumb. Get the women to do it, the men will come along eventually. When do we get the Relief Society? When is the Relief Society organized? 1820? 1830? 1840. In this case, I think it's 1842. That's reasonably late. It is a crucial, important thing to do, but it somehow was not the first thing to do. Will you tell me then, what do you do first? Do you give the word of wisdom? Everybody knows the word of wisdom. It's supposed to be for the weakest of the weak. We better start there. We don't start there. Do we start with tithing? That's something everybody knows about the church along with polygamy. Do we start with tithing or polygamy? No, we don't start there. Young adult basketball, you know, at this point we're desperate. Where do you start? Well, where did he start? If you take the prophet Joseph Smith's life from the first vision to his death and just bracket it, you just mark it on a board like that, you go from 1820 to 1844, right? Now from 1830 to 1844, we can put in all the things I've just mentioned. Word of wisdom, tithing, Relief Society, temples, except for a smidge we can add the priesthood, even the creation of the church, the establishment of the church. All of that goes in the bracket from 1830 to 1844, or at least the shadow of 1830 to 1844, if you want to have the shadow reach out to include the restoration of the priesthood in 1829. But almost everything that you know to be basic to the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ happened in the last half of the prophet Joseph's life. What I'm asking is, what happens in the first half? What happens first in the first half, once you've spoken to him and called him and let him out of that grove of trees? I'll tell you what you do first. You give him a book. You give him a book, and nothing in this world happens until that book is ready. You do not have a restoration of the gospel. You do not have the creation of the church. You do not even have something as significant as the calling of 12 apostles. When are the 12 first called? They're not called until 1835. For all this time, what seems to be fundamental and basic and elementary to the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ is a book. And is it any wonder that we teach almost uniquely in this world that the glory of God is intelligence? And that has very special meaning. And it has something to do with a book, special books, but the kind of books you'll study secularly and spiritually if you study them the way the Lord intends. Because He is talking about geology. He is talking about astronomy. He is talking about literature and biology and zoology and P.E. He is surely talking about the scriptural spiritual base for
for what it is that God knows, and what it is in part that makes him what he is. That is his glory. Now, that is a glory that is supposed to repel Satan. That is a glory that is supposed to turn him away. It is light, and it is truth, and we spell those with capital L's and capital T's. But this church and your life and our salvation somehow starts with what we broadly call education in this church. Now, it's education unlike anybody else in the world means it. It is not education the way they talk about it at Harvard or Yale. It is not education really the way they talk about it in your grade school in this state or a neighboring state. It is education in the gospel of Jesus Christ with all that that means for secular learning. But our lives in a very real way start with what we know. Why do we say in this church that you cannot be saved in ignorance? Do you know? I don't need to tell you. You do know that that is a scripture. That is scriptural. That the glory of God is intelligence, and we are supposed to be like Him, and that's why we're here. And you cannot be saved in ignorance. Joseph Smith, in fact, said you could not be saved any faster. Not only is the ultimate goal in question, but the speed is in question. That you cannot be saved any faster than you gain knowledge in this world. Let me read you a line. This is, and when I say I'm giving you a different kind of talk than I would normally give, this is it. Because it seems to me that maybe now's the time to say it, and I won't have a better chance to you this year, or perhaps any year, to say it. Let me read you a line. I've stumbled in and out of a classroom or two in my lifetime, usually tried to stumble out as fast as I stumbled in. Some of those have been philosophy classes where people sort of get together and say big words and talk about what they think the truth is. That's supposed to be the issue in a philosophy class. And I learned once, when I read it, from the prophet Joseph Smith, more about the meaning of truth than all combined philosophy classes in which I have been present. Now, that is no small thing to say about any one man's definition of something that people have worried about and taught about and talked about for as long as we know the modern world. This is what he said. Listen carefully. You've heard it before. It's from the 93rd section. Truth, the object of philosophical pursuit in this world, that is the thing around which schools traditionally have been built from ancient Greece to the present, for as long as we know what it is schools have done. Truth is knowledge of things as they are, and as they were, and as they are to come. Well, so what? Big deal. That doesn't sound like much of a definition, and I can't remember it anyway, and I don't care. And by the way, if you talk about everything that was, and everything that is, and everything that will be, that's too much for me to worry about. I'm just concerned whether I'll have a date on Friday, and don't push me beyond that. Okay? Leave that part off for a minute, will you? Just leave that part off, and listen to this line. It's the same verse, I'm just going to leave part of it out. Truth is knowledge. Question. Latter-day Saints, seminary graduates, stars on your forehead, left over from junior Sunday school. It is to you I speak. Question. Do you have the truth? Why, of course. Of course. I'm from Rupert. I have the truth. Or Rigby, or Ryrie. I can hardly say one without the others. Now, I think I know what you mean, even in testimony meeting, when you stand up and say, oh boy, I know this is the truth. I believe you. I weep with you. And I really see that changing the course of human history. That's what missionaries do, and that's what friends do, and that's what parents and children ought to do. And so I really believe that you mean it when you say that you know this is the truth. And in that sense, I think you can say that you have the truth. But I think what you're saying, according to section 93, I think what you're saying is that the church is true. That is, the church has the truth. And there's no argument about that. I will be the first at this pulpit or out the door or anywhere else, halftime of the next football game, to stand and say that the church is true, and indeed the church has the truth, the fullness of the gospel. That's my testimony, and that's yours as I hear it. But you push that just one step farther, and that's the point that makes me just a little nervous about you and about me. Set the church aside. Leave the institution aside, and President Kimball and the 12, and your stake president and branch president. We already know about them. Now, about you. Do you have the truth? And I say to you, you cannot answer that until you have answered or dealt with or grappled over this line from the 24th chapter verse of the 93rd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Namely, that truth is knowledge. And so my question to you, as haunting as it may be in the opening weeks of school, is do you have the knowledge? Do you know whereof you speak? President Brown once in our mission came. And I still remember the setting. An inspirational speech and a stimulating, inspiring message to go do missionary work. And then he closed with, as we approached a testimony meeting, which was going to follow his message, he said, I know that a lot of you will stand and say, I know the gospel's true. And he said, and I wouldn't have you not say that for anything in the world. Because I believe it and you believe it. But he says, just think about it for a minute. If it's the gospel, of course it's true. I would rather, he said to us, I would rather have you say, if it's a choice, if you could only say one or the other, I would rather have you say, I know the gospel. And if you know the gospel, I will know that you know that it's true. I plead with you to work hard this year. I plead with you to make your experience on this campus a unique, personal, spiritual, stimulating, hardworking, rigorous experience. If you have not done it yet, you need to start now to learn how to learn. You will never do it any younger. It'll never come any easier. You can this year, if you want to, change the course of human history. You can at least change the course of your human history. You can see yourself at this school, not simply because it's college, and not simply because you're supposed to, or not simply because your parents needed it, or not simply because you've got to get a job when you get out, or not simply because you want to get married. All of those, as worthy and reasonable and as acceptable as they are, there is behind all of that a theological reason, a scriptural reason for your being here. It is that you believe in your heart of hearts that you can indeed become like God. That you can be a queen or a king in this great universe of experience that is out there beyond the veil, a world which we do not yet see, but which we will someday meet as surely as that girl met that computer date. That moment will come. And if you do not know it now, you will know it then, that it mattered what you learned, how you learned it, how much you cared, and that finally there was basis to the suggestion that you could not be saved in ignorance. Let me suggest to you. Now, I know what you're going to say. I know what some of you are going to say. Some of you are going to say, that doesn't matter to me right now. That is not the reason I'm here. I want to get some other things out of the way. And that's fair enough. You do whatever it is you think you need to do. But some of you will say, in some remote recess and alcove of this campus, some of you will say, I am not a scholar. I am not interested in things like that. My family has not been, I will not be, my children will not be. We serve another way. And fair enough, in terms of actual labor, maybe you won't be a teacher or a book reader or a librarian or whatever it is that is a sort of strictly academic life. Maybe you will go and farm or ranch or serve in some other sort of capacity where you won't draw greatly on the traditional book kind of education that you're having here. I say to you that is no excuse. We are not talking about professions. We are not talking about the kind of life that simply ends, week after next or 3 weeks after next or 20 years after next. We are talking something about the state and service and scope of your soul and where it is you're going to be a long, long time from now when both the library and the ranch are gone. We're talking about you, and I would not have you, in fairness to yourself, say, I'm just not that kind of person. I've never done well in school. I just don't study well. I want to promise you right now that the question is not ability. We have more ability than willpower. You just write that down in your little black book someday. Because I promise you that when the crunch comes, when your experience at this school or anywhere in terms of your growth and your destiny and the purpose of your life, when it comes down to it, it will not be a question of your ability. God has endowed you tenfold. It's a hundredfold. It's a hundredfold more than you know and more than you now care and more than you've ever probed or proven to yourself or to anybody else. And the first time there's a tough test, or the first time that there's a rigorous course, or the first time there's the question about what else ought I to learn, some of you will say, well, I'm just not that kind of person. I say you are that kind of person. And it has nothing to do with grades. It has nothing to do with a report at the end of the year. It has really nothing to do with a diploma at all. I simply say that you are God's children. You are in design and in ultimate divinity what He is. And so don't talk to me about lack of ability. Or don't talk to me about the fact that you're a slow learner. You didn't learn to read in the second grade. What we're talking about is the ability to get on with the work. It is your will, not your ability, that is at issue here. Let me read you something that I ran across the other day. Nothing in this world can take the place of work. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb in this world. Education alone will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Work, faith, determination, these alone are omnipotent. Don't talk to me about your IQ. I don't care about your grade report in high school. I don't know anything about what you see ahead of yourself for a profession or the world of work or what you want in a husband or a wife or in children. I just tell you that I believe there's something in this church about learning and stretching and growing and becoming until indeed we are like God. And part of that task is yours this day, this year, in a way that it may never have been before. I don't know how many of you have really been away from home before. And some of you, home may be as far away as Rexburg, downtown and, you know, at three blocks and over one. That may not be very far away. Others of you will be away. Some of you will be very far away and you won't get home even at Thanksgiving time or times when you wish you might. I don't care how far away it is. But somehow there is a great watershed moment in our lives. At least there was for me. And I'm guessing that it will be one way or another for you. And that is the moment that you leave home and in that sense leave high school. And you go off to the big college or the big experience or whatever it is that begins to suggest the mild, silent snip, one by one, of those very long and very sweet and very important apron strings that have kept you very close to people you love and which you now must express, to whom you must now express that love more than ever before, because they may not be quite as close, they may not be quite as near, they may not be able to be quite as attentive as they've been some other time, some other place, and some other moment. Now, what I'm really saying is that I guess in terms of this life, we're starting to be big people right here. In the heart building, this year, we're starting to be big people. At least we ought to be. That is the assumption on which you've come here. And if you are indeed prepared to make that kind of step, then it will give you a new and sweeter relationship with your parents. It will help you understand what education, in the broadest LDS sense, not just the courses, not just the textbooks, but the kinds of things I hope I'm saying to you, I think you will then begin to understand why it is important that you do what you do for the rest of your life in a clean and wholesome and assertive way to make yourself in this life and then the next and whatever lies beyond, that you make of yourself and of each other the very best, the very most, as much as you possibly can. You have that chance this year without parental motivation in a sense that you may miss it deeply. You have a chance to sort of take your stand
and say, I have in that way come of age. I intend to be what it is I know I can be and what God has designed me to be. I'm going to start this year, this semester, in Rexburg, Idaho. That can be a very, very important time and decision in your life. Christ says, give me all. That's really what I'm talking about. I don't want so much of your time or so much of your money or so much of your work. I just want you. I haven't come to torment your natural self. I just want to kill it. No half measures are any good. I don't want to cut off a branch here and a branch there. Remember the vineyard? I want the whole tree down. I don't want to drill the tooth or crown it or stop it. I want it out. Hand over your whole natural self. All the desires which you think are innocent, as well as the ones which you think are wicked, give me the whole outfit, and I will give you a new self. I will give you a new self for the old one. In fact, I will give you myself. My will shall become your will. The terrible thing, the almost terrible thing, the almost impossible thing, is to hand over your whole self, all your wishes and your precautions, to hand them over to Christ. But it is far easier than what most of us are trying to do instead. What most of us are trying to do instead, and I suspect that means in this room right now, for good Latter-day Saints, what most of us are trying to do is remain what we call ourselves. To keep personal happiness as our great aim in life, and yet at the same time to be quite good. We're all trying to let our mind and heart go their own way, set it on money or pleasure or sex or ambition, hoping in spite of this to at least behave honestly and humbly. Now that is exactly what Christ said we could not do. He said, a thistle cannot produce figs. If I'm a field that contains nothing but grass seed, I cannot produce wheat. Cutting the grass will keep it short, but I still produce grass and no wheat. If I want to produce wheat, the change must go deeper than the surface. I must be plowed up and re-sown. It is the difference between paint, which is merely laid on the surface, and a dye or a stain that goes right through. Christ never spoke vaguely. He said, be perfect, and he meant it. Now, he meant that we must go in for the full treatment. And that is hard. School may be hard for you. Living the commandments may be hard. Obeying the teachings that you know in your heart you ought to obey, that may be hard. But we have to do it all. And if it is hard, so be it. For the compromise that we are hankering for, that is that you're used to and I am, is harder still. It is very hard for a bird to learn to fly. But it is a jolly sight harder for it to learn to fly when it is still an egg. We are like eggs at present. And you cannot go on indefinitely just being a good, decent egg. Someday you have to be hatched or go bad. Can you make some sort of resolution in your life today that at this new moment in your life, quite unlike almost any other, except I think for the missionaries who go out and the girls who finally get married and leave home, those may be the two great moments yet ahead of you. But with those, I rank this moment in your life when you, to somebody or other, if only to yourself, are saying, I'm a big person now. I'm going to do it not because mommy and daddy want me to and not because the bishop's holding my hand, but I have, in a gospel, theological, Latter-day Saint way, I have come of age. I will be what it is I've said all of my life or most of it that I would be. And I'll do it for the right reasons, in the right way, and now is the right time. It has something to do with the way you approach school. It has a great deal more to do with the way you approach your life, your heart, your mind, your thoughts, your hopes and your dreams, all of your aspirations, part of which need to be your willingness to grow and stretch and become all that God ever ordained or meant for you to become. You thought maybe that He wanted a pleasant little cottage. But as He starts to knock down walls and rip off roofs and put up shingles, you realize that He isn't dealing with a little cottage at all. What He wants is a mansion. This will be a palace under the Most High. That's what you are. I hope you like it. Because if He has anything to say about it or any way to do it, that is indeed what you'll become. I pray that you'll help Him and believe it and appreciate it. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, amen.